Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what is at stake in the upcoming midterm elections? How does our current moment fit within American history? What are the factors that will determine the election's outcome? And what does it mean for the future of the United States? We have four experts on American history and American politics with us.
Henry Brady is with us. He is the dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and a professor of political science and public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of Counting All the Votes, The Performance of Voting Technology in the United States, and co-author of Unequal and Unrepresented, Political Inequality and the People's Voice in the New Gilded Age. He's also co-author of The Unheavenly Chorus, Political Voice and the Promise of American Democracy. David Redlosk is the James Soles Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware. He's co-author of the book, The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning and Publications, Donald Trump, Contempt and the 2016 GOP Iowa Caucuses, and Donald Trump and Right-Wing Populists in Comparative Perspective. Jennifer Frost also joins us. She is Associate Professor in the Department of History at University of Auckland. She's the author of An Interracial Movement of the Poor, Community Organizing and the New Left in the 1960s, and Hedda Hopper's Hollywood, Celebrity Gossip and American Conservatism. Paul Theon also joins us. He is a senior lecturer in the Department of History at the University of Auckland and the author of Good, Reliable White Men, Railroad Brotherhoods, 1877 to 1917, and the papers, A Syndicalist Movement, Democracy, Insurgent Unionism, and the Outlaw Strike of 1920. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you all with us again. I thought what we should start with really is, what's at stake with this election? I mean, if we look at this, I guess, first from a historical perspective, how would we articulate the stakes right now? Paul, I should start with you to put this into that historic context.
I'm searching for the words to put that question into perspective. I think the stakes are as great as they have ever been. I do not think that the country has been as divided, and I don't think that the political system has been as under as great a strain as it is at the moment since the 1850s. And so I think what's at stake really in the biggest sense is, and I don't want to say that a civil war is going to happen, but I do see that the polarization in society, and as I said, the strain upon the political system, how it is seems to be coming apart, in my mind, has not happened since the 1850s, and that even surpasses the early 1970s, I believe. In the short term, of course, these elections either will act as some sort of break on the ability of the occupant of the White House to carry on as he has, or it may end up confirming in his mind his presumptive mandate.
Polarization scholars, I think, would agree with you. I've had a few of them on the Scholar Circle here before, and they have said almost precisely that, which is this is the most polarized we've been since the Civil War. I mean, I even said to somebody not long ago, you know, people ask if there's going to be a civil war, and I've heard some scholars say there's about a 60% chance, but it's almost like it's already occurring on a low guerrilla level.
Well, with this this increase in hate crimes, facilitated in part, I believe, or encouraged, if not indirectly, by the words coming out of the White House and accelerated by the dynamics of social media and the internet. Yeah, I mean, you might begin to look at it that way. But what struck me, if we are making analogies, historical analogies between the Civil War of the 1860s and the possibility of the present, is the nature of the polarization in the 1850s that had a clear regional geographical character. The geographical character of the present divide is much messier, and we've all seen maps that set out the coasts and the cities and their more liberal democratic leaning and the presumptive heartland, which seems to be leaning more conservatively. And so any sort of civil war seems to be much less clear. But Jennifer and I were talking just recently, and we think that perhaps what happened in the former Yugoslavia in the 1990s might stand as something of an example as to the kind of conflict or how conflict, if it were to happen, violence would begin to transpire.
Jennifer Frost?
Yes, and we were discussing this because, of course, before the ethnic violence broke out in the former Yugoslavia, everybody used to think of, and Yugoslavia itself used to tout itself as a place where you can have this diversity of religion, of ethnicities, of cultures, and they had achieved this wonderful, Yugoslavian dream, I guess, and how quickly that fell apart. And we know from studies of what happened in the former Yugoslavia, it was ethnic and religious hatreds being sparked by nationalist leaders seeking power. So it was not a bottom-up issue. It was not a bottom-up development. It was sparked from the top down, and it was power-hungry leaders who created that conflict. And so I do feel that this is what we're going to see. And I think the other point that, Paul making, it's not a regional divide as during the Civil War, North versus South. It's not a clear division. So it's going to be, if something happens, and we're seeing this with these hate crimes, it's neighborhood upon neighborhood, right? It's within states. It's within cities, even, that we see these kinds of this polarization.
Henry Brady, what's at stake?
Well, I'm really going to argue against the notion that we're headed for civil war. I think that's going too far. I think we have had a deterioration perhaps in the standards of how we conduct government, but I think we're going to be saved by federalism, not actually pulled apart by it. You could argue that the Civil War was basically precipitated by the fact that we did have federalism and not a strong central government. But now we've got a situation where almost every state is both blue and red. And so it would have to be conflicts within the states. And I personally don't see who the leaders of those conflicts are going to be. In Yugoslavia, you had different units of Yugoslavia, which had different languages or different religions. And you had leaders who were willing to play upon those things. I don't see how we're going to have that kind of thing happen within the states. I don't know where the leaders are going to come from and how it's going to happen. So I don't think we have to worry about that. I do think we have to worry about the tremendous polarization in our country. And I do think we have to worry about the deterioration of standards for how rhetoric is put forth and how government is conducted.
Okay. So aside from what we're, I prompted that by my own musings about there perhaps being already sort of a low-level civil war going on in the way that Jennifer and Paul have also. Of course, keep in mind, we're a lot farther away from it than you are, so we're watching it from another place, not sitting in the United States.
Although a recent poll found that one-third of those polled said they fear a civil war, which never have I seen that kind of response in the 20th century. So that's of Americans polled.
Right. Well, so aside from whether or not we end up in a civil war, or if there's kind of a low level one going on, what else do you see like really at stake here? I mean, I look at the United States. I look at a leadership that's trying to consolidate power in every branch. I see a leader who wants to not have any criticism at all and to dictate from the presidency, it seems.
This is Henry Brady again. What I see is that I hope that, and I'm saying this as a political scientist, not actually as a partisan basis, I think this is where checks and balances come in. And there's an argument to be made that if the House would go Democratic, then we would have the kind of oversight that one House of Congress can provide with respect to what's going on. And that will change the narrative substantially, because if the House Democrats do it right, which is to say they don't immediately go for impeachment and they don't even talk about impeachment. Instead, they have hearing after hearing after hearing where they point out where there's been irregularities and where there's been problems. I think that'll do what the founders hoped would happen, which is provide some break on the tendency towards an imperial presidency. And I think that's what the founders wanted to have happen. And I think if the Democrats win, which I think is probably the most likely outcome, it's not certain, it's the most likely, then we'll see the system working the way it's supposed to work.
David Redlaw.
So Dave Redlaw's here. What has struck me really over the last 2 years is how little Congress has asserted its prerogatives under the Constitution. I mean, it's been for a very long time Congress has essentially given power to the executive. But in the past, even when one party's controlled Congress and the presidency, congressional leaders have been, I'd say, sort of jealous of their powers, jealous of the position that Congress holds as the Article One branch, and have often pushed back against same-party presidents, have often challenged when they thought those presidents were overreaching. And, of course, we see none of that whatsoever here. Honestly, when Trump won and the Republicans held Congress, you know, my thought about Trump was that, okay, it's going to be interesting, but Congress is certainly not going to just lie back and let him do and say anything he wants. Obviously, I misread that completely.
Paul Talon.
Sorry, what strikes me about both your, David and Henry's, remarks, and I agree with you, it's hard to envision a civil war, but I certainly can envision, depending on the course of the next few weeks, the kind of violence that we've already seen in society, and a Democratic win in the House would certainly act as a check. But it's your emphasis of the structure of government and federalism, and arguably what's distinct, if not unique, about the American political system. And would it be fair to say that you are placing your either confidence or views as to the near future in that system of government, irrespective of personalities and politics? And I might also follow up with, David, your remark, how you would see the functioning of the Republican Party in terms of Congress's role with the executive.
So this is Henry Brady. Let me just provide a really short answer, which is, again, I'm in California, by the way, and we now have a gubernatorial candidate right now who's almost certainly going to win, Gavin Newsom, who's running ads which start with Mr. Trump's face talking about how California is a bad actor and so forth, and Gavin Newsom then coming on and saying, well, Mr. Trump, we're going to continue to be that way. That's what we're going to do. We're going to keep pushing for the things that are important to California. So we have here in California a sense that somehow through the federal system, we're going to continue to do the things we think are important with respect to climate change and immigration and so on and so forth, and that the central government is not as important to us as it is to Mr. Trump.
And that is sort of fascinating. I mean, California certainly, you know, what is it, the world's sixth largest economy or something of that nature. California is very much its own place in some sense. But I think that's really right. To a great extent, we probably, and certainly the media and certainly the world, sort of overemphasizes the role the federal government plays. It's not that it doesn't play a very important role in American politics, but individual states continue to have wide latitude in what they do. And I suspect that's, you know, that is one of the backstops in this system. But I think the other backstop is if Congress in any form asserts itself, whether it's Democrats taking control of one of the houses, whether it's, you know, some set of Republicans, you know, taking a new look because they get bashed up in this election, whatever it might be. It's worth recalling that, you know, for his outsized influence, because he is the president of the United States, you know, Donald Trump has never had anything really close to majority support in the United States. And I honestly think I feel like this backlash that he represents is to some degree, maybe this is just being hopeful and not really data driven, a kind of rear guard last ditch effort against the inevitable change that is happening.
As a native Californian myself, I have kept up to date on California politics. I don't vote there any longer, but I keep up with what's happening in California. And two things concern me. One is the Republican tax cut that happened last year that really targeted the blue states and targeted high tax states that were able to deduct their federal taxes from their, no, sorry, the state taxes from their federal taxes. And to lose much of that was really an assault against some of the measures that states like California, New Jersey, New York are trying to do to keep their schools stronger, work on environment, et cetera. So I really see that as an example of how federalism, in this case, the federal government was able to undermine the budget, the goals of some of the states. The other thing that scares me with Brett Kavanaugh, and I know the focus was very much on overturning Roe v. Wade if he became part of the Supreme Court. What scares me as well is I've heard that there is cases at the ready to come to the Supreme Court to allow gun owners with a license in one state to carry their guns into another state, just as we can use our driver's license in different states. And that could be an example of the federal government undermining the power of states with gun control. So I'm not so sure that no matter how strong these states are, that they can protect themselves from, you know, the federal government. And, you know, again and again, you know, Californians will say we return more tax money to the federal government than we get back. And, you know, obviously that's not, that's not being considered or recognized or respected.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with top scholars about the midterm election, what it means for the United States, what might happen, and how it compares with other moments in the U.S. history.
We've been talking about sort of the governance aspect of it. I want to also go into the other factors that are going to play into this election. And before I really turn to the campaigns, to participation, to actual voting, David Redlawsk, you've studied polarization from an emotional perspective. And I want to understand how important that is and how much longevity that might have. Can you walk us through emotional polarization and why that matters and for how long it might matter?
Politics is always been about emotions. We've had some trouble studying that in any kind of systematic way. Emotions are kind of hard to get a handle on. So political scientists have often kind of lumped this into some broad assessment of feeling towards a candidate or what have you. More recent work has looked at individual emotions like anger and anxiety, and some work I've done recently with some colleagues on contempt. You know, those negative emotions are clearly important in politics. It's obviously, if you watch a negative campaign ad, something that I've also looked at more generally, you find that, you know, they're dripping with these negative emotions purposefully. They're meant often to generate fear, or more recently, we're seeing a lot of contempt where candidates really are using phrases in their ads that are meant to virtually dehumanize the opposition. And of course, we see a lot of this in the rhetoric that Trump uses on Twitter. And it's easy for us to kind of say, okay, this is something new and it's something especially bad at this moment, and it's really hard to see a way out of it. If people hate each other, if people are contemptuous of each other, you know, it might not be that far from being contemptuous of your neighbor because she's a Democrat to wanting to round them, you know, all of them up and put them in camps. Right. So there is reason to think that these emotional responses we're having matter a heck of a lot. It's also hard to see how you get past that when you have leaders who essentially foment that kind of emotional response on a regular basis. I will say, though, you know, politics has always been emotional. You know, emotions are always part of it, and negative campaigning has been part of it for as long as there's been campaigning. The difference, I think, and I this is not something I've looked at systematically, but others have, right? I think the kinds of communications we have today, especially through social media, are just reinforcing those senses of negativity and those attack emotions.
And contempt in particular, I think, because it really drives a wedge, contempt and hate, in a way that anger and fear don't necessarily.
Yeah, anger is basically an attack emotion. You're appraising that other people are causing unpleasant outcomes, blocking your goals when it's seen as unfair. You know, there's a sense that, you know, this is actually motivating. It actually gets you to do something to try to change the behavior. Contempt, on the other hand, is more about rejection. It's really intended to say that my opponent is the other and doesn't even deserve consideration. And so rather than it being something that, let's say, positively motivates people, if you can say anger positively motivates them, but it does, to go try to do something, contempt is very much about driving a wedge and about saying the other guy just doesn't even deserve anything whatsoever. They're not human.
Yeah, lock her up kind of mentality. Yeah. When you did your experiments on contempt, did you find it was more powerful than other emotions?
We found there's some difficulty in disentangling individual emotions like this, but we have found that contempt had different kinds of effects. We were looking, for example, at the 2016 election, and we found that contempt that was perceived by voters in ads actually seemed to backlash against the candidate who expressed the contempt, who had the contemptuous ad, which is a little bit of a hopeful point, right? Anger did what the sponsoring candidate wanted to do. That is, anger made people more negative about the target. Contempt, at least in 2016, as we were looking at the data, didn't seem to do that. But I take that a little bit with a grain of salt. I mean, it's one study, it's one circumstance.
Henry Brady, let's just bring you in on this, too, because I know you've looked at campaigns overall and their effects. With this new research that David has been doing on emotions, how would you see this in the kind of grander scheme? I know your big study was in up till 2006, but I'm more than certain that you've done more since then, and how they've been changing and what the effects seem to be.
Yeah, I think the truth is, and I'm so happy to see people in political science working now on emotions because we really have to understand them better. I would say another thing we have to understand better is paranoia in politics, because part of what we're seeing on the web these days is incredible paranoid notions of what is going on in the world. And for example, within just a few hours of the bombs being sent to the various people and it being reported, I was actually going into Canada and I talked to a person who was exchanging currency for me. And he said, "Is it true that those bombs were actually sent by Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama so they could seem like martyrs?" And apparently that was all over the web. And somebody in Canada had seen that and believed that it might be true. And if you think about it for just a few moments, it just simply probably can't be true. And it would just be pretty darn bizarre because it would have to involve a lot of people who would be in on the conspiracy. But we have people who believe conspiracies which involve lots and lots and lots of people, and they are emotionally attached to those conspiracies. And that's an area we have to understand better because it's part of the problem we have right now with getting information out to people.
Yes, just to add to that, that idea of a black flag operation, as it's called, that was also endorsed by Fox News. And it was also endorsed by Rush Limbaugh. So part of the problem we have is these paranoid conspiracies are not just on social media. You know, they're on the news. They are filtering into this audience for it. And I guess when I first heard this, of course, I was shocked just as you. But then I was hoping after the arrest, and it was clear that the, a person was a Trump supporter, that the Fox and Rush Limbaugh would dial it back, would say, "Oh, we were wrong." We heard nothing. They never dialed it back. They never said they were wrong. So, you know, we have these paranoid conspiracies that get amplified into the media and they're never corrected, even when, as you know, we have facts that come to light. So what concerns me is, as exactly what you're saying, how do we deal with this if the regular mechanisms for testing those kinds of theories, challenging them and overturning them aren't working?
Of course, we know that that is how they maintain their audiences and how they make a lot of money. So even in times when there might be an actual disagreement or a sense of responsibility, the bottom line may be driving some of that. That would have to be tested, too.
This all, let me, Dave, here, this also feeds into the human tendency, basically, to want to support your prior beliefs. We put this under the idea of motivated reasoning, right? That new information that challenges prior beliefs is very hard to assimilate. We tend to reject it. We tend to not want to update those prior beliefs. And that makes correcting errors of fact quite difficult. It makes getting people to change their opinions quite difficult. And it makes correcting, in particular, conspiracy theories extraordinarily difficult.
And I remember back, I don't know, a decade ago when Drew Weston did the brain scans that actually saw the cognitive dissonance when there was information that challenged a partisan's belief system, even when it was true. So, I mean, how can a country hold it together with these issues? Henry Brady, this is for you.
Well, I think the answer is, again, institutional structures are designed to try to make sure that the institutions can guard against the worst impulses of human beings. We're imperfect people, as the Federalist Papers noted, and that we have to have institutions that can make sure that imperfect people can maybe make a democracy work. And that's why I'm at least somewhat hopeful because of things like federalism, things like balance of powers, and the hope that those things will kick in and have an impact. I do think, though, that we also have to be thinking about how K through 12 education is providing civics education, because I worry that we give people lots of facts and information about the Constitution and how many senators there are per state and so on and so forth. But we don't explain to them that how hard it would be to pull off some of the conspiracies that people believe in. And I wonder if there's ever any exercises, and I doubt it, in any of these civics courses that says, okay, let's take one of these conspiracy theories and understand what would be required for that to be true and how many people would have to be lying and what the likelihood is that that many people would be lying, and the likelihood that there would be no incentive for them to tell the truth, because there are incentives. And by the way, this spills over into science right now. For people who believe that global warming is a hoax, they should know there are PhD students out there who are probably right now trying to show why some of the research of their elders is wrong. And if they prove that global warming is wrong, they're going to win a Nobel Prize. I mean, that's Nobel Prize territory. And so we do have mechanisms that can try to correct these things, but I'm not sure that the average person knows that they exist and how powerful they can be to correct mistakes.
One of the other things I wanted to get to, and Jennifer Frost, this is kind of your area, is since Donald Trump has ascended to the presidency, there have been massive protests and movements. I saw a piece, I think it was Erica Chenoweth did, that counted more than 8,700 protests. And it said 74% of those protests were either against Trump policy or issues that conflicted with his viewpoint. How would you help us to understand this over the course of American history? Is this unusual? Is this match something in our history?
So as a U.S. historian, when I think about these moments of protests and social movements, that, yes, often they coexist or prompt social reform. So if we think back to the social movements before the Civil War, abolition and women's rights and temperance, that did lead to legal reform, political reform. We think, of course, of the progressive era of the late 19th and early 20th century, similarly had myriad movements that pushed for reforms, both of politics and government. And then we can look to the New Deal. We can also look to the 1960s. So these moments when we have had protest and social movements on a great scale in the past have led to some really important progressive social change. So the question is this going to happen now? And are they going to translate the protest into voting? Because we know that's obviously the tool that we have, and that's where it has to be. So that's, for me, obviously, that's the question of the midterms. Do all those protests translate into voters who are able to make a difference? Their vote's not suppressed or it's not diluted. You know, one of the problems of mobilizing people in California is, you know, you can have all these extra Democrats voting and, you know, my sister complains that her vote doesn't go anywhere. Of course, she still votes. But I think that's really the question. Is this going to translate into power at the ballot box?
Well, Henry Brady, I think that goes to you. You've looked at voting behavior as well as the cost of voting. So how do you see this?
Well, I think there are obviously tremendous efforts right now to mobilize various populations. Mr. Trump is trying to do that by his campaign rallies, and I'm sure he'll have some effect on mobilizing the base. And Democrats are working desperately to mobilize populations, especially groups like Hispanics. And then there's suburban women who I think are going to play an enormously important role in this election, especially suburban women who may have voted Republican in the past, but who may be outraged and upset about Justice Kavanaugh and who may be upset about Mr. Trump's comments and attitudes towards women. And we see a tremendous gender gap. So there's no question that they are concerned. The question is, can they be mobilized and brought out to vote? And that's where I think the battleground is going to be of these elections right now that we're seeing.
David Redlosk.
Just to say, the fascinating thing is that in all of the polling, voters are far more likely to say they're certain to vote than they were in 2014. It's not quite at 2016 levels, but it's extraordinarily high for a midterm. Now, we know that them saying they're certain to vote is very different from actually voting. So that, you know, there's a good 20 or 25 point difference. But right now, about 75% of those in polls say they are certain to vote. If that turned out to be 45 to 50% turnout in the midterm, that would be pretty stunning.
Paul Tallon, you've been silent for a while, and this kind of speaks to some of the work that you've done as well with regards to labor and what has happened to the labor movement in the United States. How do you see this with the big historic arc?
Well, this current government has gone even further in whittling away or taking away key political legal mechanisms that have been important to the labor movement. The recent Supreme Court decisions, and I'm trying just to draw these to mind now, have pushed back. Yeah, the Janus decision, NLRB rulings too, and having to do with membership dues and the kind of mechanisms that tend to try and capture free riders. And so it's really a continuation of a story that we've seen since the 1980s with the Reagan administration. At the same time, there has been enormous energy, I think, evident from the same sector that this government and various state governments have taken aim at, that is public sector employees and especially teachers, as we have seen. The kinds of commentary I've noticed have begun to emphasize that unions really need to mobilize their members and really need to be out in the picket line. And of course, recently, the right to picket has been curtailed. And in the long historical view, we might be, we're looking at the dismantling of key elements of the New Deal labor relations regime. And the kind of commentary I've observed seems to be reminiscent of the pre-1930s state of play, when we're looking at the ability of unions to conduct industrial action and to force employers. And that kind of moment ultimately came down to a test of power and will. Of course, in the present moment, the balance of power rests very much in the side of employers with the orientation of the state.
One interesting poll that I had just seen was that millennials favor unions by about 78%. I mean, a huge number, which makes sense given that they came of age in the Great Recession of 2008. And so they understand the importance of some power in the workplace. So that to me is interesting. So again, we were talking about different groups that need to get out to vote. And we also know that it is young people that need to vote. And in recent registrations to vote, young people 18 to 24 are one of the largest groups who are registering to vote. So hopefully they do come to vote. And, you know, we've even seen celebrities like Taylor Swift, who's always been apolitical, saying, you know, get out to vote, register, et cetera. So part, and I think of the young people of the Parkland shooting who organized their Never Again movement and calling politicians to account on gun control. So part of me as a historian who also does work on the 26th Amendment and the campaign that achieved the right for 18, 19, and 20-year-olds to vote, I'm putting some of my eggs in that basket, so to speak.
Well, that also...
Well, and sorry to jump back in.
Yes.
Sorry, Maria. We might also be seeing something of a refiguring of the labor movement away from the old, obviously, primary sector unions, which emphasized or were all about maintaining the full employment and wages of white male wage earners, and increasingly women, but also heads of households, to a labor movement that is talking much more about matters of economic justice, and which are attuned to this economy in which temporary, short-term employment, the gig economy, is much more the reality for more and more younger workers.
Henry Brady, you've studied inequality, political participation as well. How do you see the issues like this playing into current politics and the election that's coming up on Tuesday?
Well, I think inequality is still a major issue confronting America. And I think we also should recognize that although there's just no question but that some of the animus that led to Trump was based upon xenophobia and racism, I think it is also the case, although people differ on this, that I think economic matters also were important in inequality and the slow wage growth of certain groups. And that, I think, is a problem. And I, by the way, I also think that many of the people who voted for Trump maybe in the past would have been members of labor unions. And I think labor unions would have involved them in the elections in different ways. And they might have been much more likely to have been Democratic voters. And instead, when they don't have a labor union to hear from and to learn from, they may be more willing to go in other directions from what a labor movement would send them. And I think that's probably an important factor also in where we are right now.
You know, I wonder, too, we started this section talking about the movements that have developed and all of the protests and how many that our colleague Erica Chenoweth had counted. And David Redlask, I'm going to bring you back into this because this could be affected by something like contempt, couldn't it? Can movements like this, do they further generate emotions like contempt between camps? And I know you primarily look at ads, but I wonder if you could theorize about the effect of an emotion like this on these movements.
You know, I think the challenge here is, again, kind of disentangling different possible motivations, different possible emotions. You know, a lot of this is about trying to protect one's own position in some form or another, being brought into a group, let's say, that is trying to rebuild a union movement is about doing what you think is better for you, but also for society as a whole. Inevitably, when we create in-groups, we create out-groups. People are not part of the group. But to be able to say this is specifically about being contemptuous, or it's about anger, or it's about anxiety, it's a little harder to disentangle. But nonetheless, clearly, some of these movements are driven by contempt for others. You've got to think that the kinds of things we saw in Charlottesville, the neo-Nazi kind of approach, the stuff that goes on that's being fomented by the clear contemptuous speech of the president about different groups creates some of that, most obviously. But I think a lot of this, when you think about millennial, I want to go back to the turnout thing, right, and younger voters. If we're hanging our hat on younger voters, we might be disappointed, but I still think we're going to see substantial improvements in turnout of younger voters. But the evidence is we're also going to see increases in turnout among older voters. The interest just seems to be up kind of across the board.
Henry Brady, your idea about the costs of voting and the natural experiments that you've done with the actual infrastructure of voting, the physical act of voting. I read a report, or at least the abstract of the report, I confess, from the Brennan Center for Justice, and they reported 99 new laws in something like 31 states that are in one way or another making voting harder. What do you think, based on your research, was going to be the effect of these?
Well, I think there's no question that those kinds of laws are meant to suppress turnout. And it's going to be interesting to see if we do see that happening. It seems likely that many of them will. I mean, some of these laws include such things as getting rid of voting before the election and making it harder to get absentee ballots. And other ways that you can make it hard to vote, including registration. So, for example, purging people from lists and making it so that you have to re-register or that you have to provide some significant amount of identification in order to register and then to vote. And the sad thing about all of this is that we are at a point technologically where we could have same-day registration for everybody in every state, and we could make it very easy to vote if we wish to do so. And you would think that in a democracy that values voting, that we would be doing that. But unfortunately, we're going in many states in the opposite direction, not in every state, but in many states. And so that is something I think that it could very well affect this election.
I saw that in Oregon, they are changing the law to automatically registered and that you have to actually opt out rather than opt in. So that would be going in the other direction.
Right. So absolutely. So some states are trying to find ways to make it easier to vote. And I think that's a good thing. Now, Republicans would tell you that actually they want to make it hard because that way only the people who really care will go to vote, and that will make sure that you have an electorate that's better informed and so forth. But I don't actually think that's necessarily the case, because some of the people who won't vote will be people who simply have days where they just don't have any extra time to go register or to vote in these more complicated ways. So I think it's not the case that necessarily you're going to get a better electorate that way. I think what it means is there's certain people who are going to be excluded, and they're typically going to be people who are of lower socioeconomic status and who are racial minorities and so forth. So it seems to me it's anti-democratic at its core.
Yeah, they've also put forward the argument that they are countering voter fraud. Hasn't that been debunked?
There's essentially no evidence that there's any significant voter fraud. Every time anybody goes and looks for it, you find just a very, very little bit of it. But it's just a small, small number of cases. And some of it is just laughable on its face. The notion, for example, that illegal immigrants are going to be showing up at voting places to vote, where there are often friends and neighbors who will wonder who they are and who might turn them in, and that they want to vote so much and do something illegal that they're willing to risk going to jail for it. It just strikes me as, again, another one of those paranoid fantasies that if you think about it for a moment, you'd say, that doesn't seem very likely. Most of the folks who are here and are undocumented are not going to be showing up at voting places so that they risk getting arrested.
Do you think these have enough of an effect collectively to have a final vote tally that benefits, say, one party or another?
Well, I mean, we could end up with close races in a bunch of congressional districts. So, for example, the various estimates of what the margin's going to be for the Democrats go from maybe they will get 202 seats, which won't be enough to control Congress, to they'll get 260. But the average is around 220, 222, somewhere in through there. That means they've only got a margin of about 4 or 5 seats. And so it wouldn't take too many districts in which voter suppression has caused Democratic voters not to vote to change the elections towards the Republicans.
And then finally, I know some political scientists and some computer scientists were working together on trying to see how reliable these voting machines are. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think optical scan machines are pretty good machines and work pretty well. And electronic machines with a paper trail are extremely reliable and good machines. So we have technologies that work extremely well these days and are quite auditable. Unfortunately, we have a very decentralized system of procuring and employing voting machines. It's done at the county level and sometimes even at the township level. And we have often amateurs doing the procurement and not necessarily getting the best machines or maintaining them in the best possible way. So there's lots of ways that just bad machines can lead, which is what happened in Florida in 2000, that really sort of bad machines for counting votes can lead to the outcome of a presidential election in that case.
Just a reminder that this is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing emotional campaigns, the politics of contempt, and the possible effects of the new legal barriers to voting in some states.
In Florida, also, there was the purging of black voters from the voter rolls, which did amount to, you know, I mean, since it was such a hairline in the end, that did matter. I understand there are four states that are doing that as well now.
Right. And that's another thing that needs to be there's voter rolls should be purged, but they should be purged extremely carefully and not with just an attempt to try to eliminate people for whom the match isn't exact, for example. There's got to be a lot more leeway to remember that matches, even inexact matches, might be the same person. And so there's just got to be a better way to do that.
Yeah, you know, another electoral reform that I've heard about is having nonpartisan electoral commissions that cover this. So we don't have the Secretary of State, who has a party affiliation, being in charge of the voter rolls. We just saw in Georgia, Brian Kemp, who's running for governor against Stacey Abrams, you know, being in charge of a purge of a half a million voters. So we obviously can't have the fox in charge of the hen house, which also happened in Florida in 2000. So, you know, there's a great, so many good proposals for electoral reform in the United States. The question is, you know, where's the will and also the funding to be able to make these changes? It has to happen. I remember when Obama won in 2008, in his acceptance speech in Chicago in Grant Park, he said, we've got to fix this electoral system. And that didn't, that obviously didn't happen.
Well, let's do a round of final thoughts. Paul Tallon?
Oh, well, I it's not really a concluding thought, just that I tend to see where the nation is at the current moment, you know, in terms of politics and division. I draw a line to the late 60s and to the divisions of the 60s, the playing out of the New Deal coalition and growth liberalism that sustained that New Deal coalition, and the ways in which issues like civil rights tended to cut across that coalition and open the door to reactionary politics, and the way in which, in particular, Richard Nixon perfected a form of politics as war, which must be won at all costs, and which left little room for compromise, and which demonized the other, and which Newt Gingrich perfected in the 1990s, and which McConnell has carried on through the Obama administration, and which has metastasized into the present. And so I see a longer history down to the present. And we might also add, as I think, I'm sorry, whether it was Harriet David pointed out, that the hollowing out of the American dream, which has steadily, the income inequality has steadily increased broadly since the 1970s, and particularly since the 2008 recession, and the way in which governments responded to that has left a lot of anger and resentment and has gotten to this present moment.
Jennifer?
I guess similarly, and in fact, I would say as a historian of the 1960s, I feel we are at a worse place now than we were at that point for a lot of reasons. And one of the main reasons is that politics of war, it wasn't governance as war. And so you still had a Congress that could work together. And again, these stories about political polarization, even if polarization starts to accelerate in the 70s, you know, you still have people working across the aisle. And I guess what scares me is that politics of war has gone into how we govern. And I guess McConnell's a great example of that, denying a sitting president a Supreme Court pick. So that's what really bothers me. And I think we started the whole conversation saying, you know, Congress hasn't done its job to be a check on the president. So really, I'm quite fearful and but also hoping for the best on Tuesday.
David Redlosk.
Well, I'm going to use the trite phrase that it all comes down to turnout. But of course, it does all come down to turnout in the American system, where, you know, voting is an option rather than required. People have to decide to get out and vote if they're going to expect anything to change. We talked about it earlier, and I think Henry noted how much work is going into turning people out. And it's happening, of course, on both sides. You know, the evidence is that turnout's likely to be really up. But what will matter in the end is the ground game that Democrats have versus the game that Republicans have. Do they get their people actually to the polls, either in early voting right now or on Tuesday?
It reminds me also, one thing we didn't talk about, and of course we don't have time now, is the gerrymandering of the districts, but that maybe we save that for another conversation. So, Henry Brady, you get the last words.
Sure. Well, as I think I've said, I put my faith in institutions to make sure that the American system stays sound. I think federalism has served it well, and certainly for the last 150 years. And I think that with the strong possibility that Congress is going to be taking over the House by Democrats, I think the balance of powers will make sure, checks and balances will make sure that there's some oversight on the presidency. I should note that Clinton in 94 faced a situation where he lost the House. It took 4 or 6 years before Bush did, but that's because of 9/11. But in 2006, he lost the House. Obama lost in 2014. That historical progression suggests that Trump's going to lose in 2018. And all the polls seem to suggest right now that that's the most likely outcome. It's not for sure, but it seems like the most likely outcome.
And I suppose it does depend on all of these factors that we've been talking about. And there are many of them. So we better start our regression analysis. So with that, I thank you, all four of you. It's just been wonderful to host you and all your insight. It's really profound.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Maria.
Henry Brady is the Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of Counting All the Votes, The Performance of Voting Technology in the United States, and co-author of Unequal and Unrepresented, Political Inequality and the People's Voice in the New Gilded Age. He's also co-author of The Unheavenly Chorus, Political Voice and the Promise of American Democracy. David Redlosk is the James Soles Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware. He's co-author of the book, The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning and Publications, Donald Trump, Contempt and the 2016 GOP Iowa Caucuses, and Donald Trump and Right-Wing Populists in Comparative Perspective. Jennifer Frost is Associate Professor in the Department of History at University of Auckland. She's the author of An Interracial Movement of the Poor, Community Organizing and the New Left in the 1960s, and Hedda Hopper's Hollywood, Celebrity Gossip and American Conservatism. Paul Theon is a senior lecturer in the Department of History at the University of Auckland and the author of Good, Reliable White Men, Railroad Brotherhoods, 1877 to 1917, and the papers A Syndicalist Movement, Democracy, Insurgent Unionism, and the Outlaw Strike of 1920. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.